Hi, this is Chris France of Talking Heads, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC, Accra.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes with the brooding ambient strains of Nadia Khan. Music from Sweden's Das Orchester, a glitchy sound poem from Dasha Rush, and a chilling jazz fugue by Leonard Bernstein. Deep Threes. Music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Hilo Catskill, cafe, bar, art gallery, and performance space located at 365 Main Street, Catskill, New York. Waveform's WGXC is pleased to broadcast live from Hilo every Tuesday morning starting at 9 a.m. In addition, Hilo live events are streamed and broadcast in conjunction with the Waveform Radio Transmit Partner Program.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Karen Locker of Kingston, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM, listener supported radio.
Hey, it's Kevin Factor, and this is a special homespun edition of Foraging Ahead. I say homespun because tonight is a patchwork of poetry and stories and rants and music from artists, writers, and musicians. Recording in their living rooms, dens, kitchens, closets, sub-basement, garages. Most were made during this time. Some before, some address it, some don't. And some are professionals and semi-professionals, some dabblers, dilettantes, amateurs, and me, yours truly. Some are dark, some are light, some are funny, some are serious, some are sad, some are happy. Some you will like, some you won't like, but there's stuff in here for everybody, because it seems like so many people contributed to this show, and I just want to thank them. The words, we have poets and writers, Marianne Murray and Sarah Wisby, Nikki Lambros, Mickey Laval, Pete Mooney, and we have songs and music by Chi Ho Han, Tim Davis, and Vanessa Brown. I hope you enjoy it. And stay safe.
When things break, they do so surely and quickly, and sometimes permanently. Everything so delicately perched.
John don't buy no foreign name. He won't drive it 'cause of feeling of shame. He works that bodega every night and day, and keeps it all fresh with his hose and spray. Yeah, this is a walking song. Well, it can't be right when it feels so wrong. Oh, on a morning train. Joe can't last not even one more day. He thinks about his tragic youth. Well, he didn't get shit when he lost his tooth. Oh yeah, this is his walking song. Well, it can't be right when it feels so wrong. Tracy sleeps in an old white house. She drives all day like on a carousel. Now she's dreaming of the California coast. Well, she's still haunted by that little girl's ghost. Yeah, this is a walking song. Well, it can't be right when it feels so wrong. Charlie's digging in his heels. His 10th floor office has an airtight seal. He's got his wool suit and quarter vent, but he'd give it all up for Tracy's heart again. Oh yeah, this is his walking song. Well, it can't be right when it feels so wrong.
What it's come to. On my way to work, I refuse a clown's hug. Feel like an asshole about it, denying a clown a hug, his deflation literal. Poor clown, looking for hugs on a city street, us too jaundiced to give hugs freely. Enough creepers out there where any bozo can put on a clown suit and feel you up.
The portable grave. He carries it with him everywhere he goes. Someone told him he would have eternal nightmares if he died and wasn't buried in hallowed ground. So he went to the churchyard and dug up some earth and filled a pouch and sewed it inside his shirt just above his solar plexus. That way, if he died, he would lie under hallowed ground no matter if anyone bothered to bury him. These were plague times, and many were left unburied, dumped in huge piles on the outskirts of town. But what if I fall forward? He made another pouch and filled it with more dirt, sewed it into the back of his shirt, and congratulated himself on his readiness. Everywhere he went, he could smell the loamy scent rising from his chest, and he felt safe and loved. His village was a mess. The stench of death was everywhere. As if that wasn't bad enough, people who were otherwise healthy were hell-bent on killing themselves through drink or killing their neighbors for the smallest slights. He was lucky to love God and to love himself. The odors that rose from his body, not just the dirt, but the sweat and the semen and the stench of his faraway feet, all the smells of a man reminded him of that. But what if I fall to one side? He liked to sleep on his side, with his legs tucked up next to him, so it made sense that he might die in this position, too. He made two more pouches and fastened them to his belt loops, one on either side. They swung there, and he felt their weight like a second pair of testicles, only these were designed to protect him, not the other way around. Some people carried posies to ward off disease. He did not believe in tampering with God's will. The soul is a flower, and it will open only after God has plucked it. What if I stumble and fall into a cistern, head first, with my legs in the air like branches? Ha! He knew he was getting carried away. But the more he thought about this possibility, the more it troubled him. He pictured the tree of his wronged body, first with his pants hanging off in tatters, then his flesh, and then with noisy birds resting in his bones. How would he ever rest? It would be like trying to sleep with no eyelids under a bright sun. He crept back to the churchyard with his trowel and 10 tiny sacks. He would tie one to each of his toes and be done with it. He would lay down his horror of death and go on with the business of living. He would take a wife and store his life in her body. He would give her everything he had, which was nothing, but it would become something inside of her. The spot he had chosen to gather his dirt was atop a freshly dug grave, where the soil was looser and he could just scoop it into the bags. Suddenly a voice called to him to stop. A light shone in his face. The penalty for grave robbing was death by hanging, even if all you stole was dirt. They hung him in the forest from a low branch because they were in a hurry. His toes dangled inches from the ground so that it was easy to mistake him from a distance for a man walking towards you at an incredibly slow pace. Children shouted at him and threw sticks, and when he did not move, they came closer and dared one another to poke at him. The man who was supposed to cut him down either forgot or died of plague. His tongue swelled up purple and eventually burst, staining his shirt. Birds came to nest in his skeleton. And what if I die upright, standing at the ready, waiting for God to pluck me?
His hands are stretched above his head, skin the color of the dead, laying upon a tilted table where the waters had flowed down into his nose and mouth over the filthy cloth as though he were being drowned. Tell us where the answer's hidden, how you planned the Armageddon in the land that once held Eden. Babylon the Great has fallen deep into a spider hole. There is no hope for you in heaven. Tell us now, tell us now, tell us again how and where and when. He did not think he was a martyr then. Yea, he did not die, not once, not 183 times. Mohammed, why hast thou forsaken all around you who were taken? There was nothing more to say. It was extracted anyway. I knew a man, I knew another, he babbled on and on. Oh yes, she was my brother. It was I who struck that face, saying, prophesy, with my terrible sword of vengeance. I plundered the pearl of great price. And this was later proven true. The hieroglyphers had scanned the bulging vein in his blessed right hand and said, yes, it was surely you. It was all done by him, from A to Z, everything since 1993, including the bombing of Bali and shooting John Paul II, or at least plotting to. His little children, 6 and 8, were locked behind a metal gate and testified until they named everyone they knew. So now the truth is known. The icon looks like all the rest, just a man tortured to near death. Ecce homo, the icon's model lies unseen in Guantanamo.
Caught it. COVID isolation to-do list, day something. Item 1, wake up, optional. Item 2, get dressed, optional. 3, coffee. 4, grunt at family and confirm that elderly cat's still alive. 5, news. 6, coffee and amphetamines and Xanax. Item 7, eat breakfast or not, but probably most important meal of the day. Insert random semi-structured intervals throughout day of child-centered madness and your inability to teach them anything because you can't even understand how they do division these days or what exactly the hell is an adverb again. And how long, really, does it take this kid to read a paragraph and thanking the heavens above for your wife who is the brains and backbone of this operation and will certainly get us through the apocalypse. Item 8, coffee. 9, stare at work computer screen for a while, without checking email, of course, because we know it happens then, and think about all the things I really should be doing, like designing ventilators in my garage, spending more time with my kids, trailblazing innovative approaches to vaccine production, dismantling the patriarchy, fabricating an entirely new career from scratch because I am not sure I will ever have a job again. I'm not qualified for any real jobs. Quit sniffing glue, restructuring approaches to national health care, attacking income and racial inequalities head on, getting that weird bump on my back looked at, disrupting educational paradigms by designing an entirely new national curriculum and forcing Texas to just deal with it, working on my relationship, getting a responsible, non-scumbag elected president, and finally, dealing with global warming once and for all. 10, do Facebook for a few hours instead. 11, coffee. Insert really long, semi-manic, rambling Facebook posts at random points throughout the day, but usually before 2 p.m. This one counts. Item 12, coffee. 13, 20 to 30 minutes of actual work, what little you have left, following 2-hour anxiety attack about same. Insert various randomly spaced medical infusions throughout the day to help. 14, think wistfully about last cup of coffee you had. 15, remember that you forgot lunch right before having dinner. See item 6 plus infusions. 16, remember all the shit you were supposed to think about doing earlier but didn't. See infusions. 17, as it is getting dark, think about what you should have worked on outside. 18, go to bed for a while and ponder your mortality and what has become of you and your role in the world. 19, get out of bed for dinner. 20, kid bedtime. Alternatively, yay, NyQuil time. 21, spend 20 minutes cleaning studio. 22, TV time. 23, bedtime, where you spend an inordinate amount of time considering points 1 through 24 of the day and question all of your decisions and vow to use your privilege to do better the next day before falling asleep in a cloud of drug-induced bliss and fear-induced anxiety. Item 24, get up and pee. Damn it. 25, go back to bed. 26, start all over again.
Now, my fellow Americans are singing the blues, 'cause coronavirus is making news. And no one knows just where it's heading, but it's probably not Armageddon. I'm gonna have a heart attack, though, 'cause I'm a hypochondriac. And it's 1, 2, 3, what am I coughing for? Is this COVID-19? Should I self-quarantine? And it's 5, 6, 7, sanitize the pearly gates. Well, it won't be time to say goodbye. We were all gonna die. The nightly news interviewed a nurse, said it's like the flu, except it's much, much worse. A different doctor says it's just a cold, unless you're immunocompromised.
or old. One thing on which they all agree, you're fine as long as you don't breathe. And it's 1, 2, 3, what am I coughing for? Is this COVID-19? Should I self-quarantine? And it's 5, 6, 7, sterilize the pearly gates. We'll have time to say goodbye, but we were all gonna die. This pandemic now demands that all good citizens wash your hands, and if you want to save the human race, for the love of God, don't touch your face. And if your neighbors don't all comply, you can kiss your ass goodbye. 'Cause it's 1, 2, 3, what am I coughing for? Is this COVID-19? Should I self-quarantine? And it's 5, 6, 7, sanitize the pearly gates. Gone to hell, unless you own stock in Purell. We can only hope this little germ might prevent Trump's second term. One thing he's proved once and for all, you can't stop a virus with a wall. And it's 1, 2, 3, what am I coughing for? Is this COVID-19? Should we also quarantine? And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly.
The hole in my fence. Times being what they are, one must be resourceful. As current and projected revenue streams will fall short of the anticipated expenditures, I am seizing the bull by its horns. I am grabbing my bootstraps and giving them a mighty yank. I am taking a cue from one of our greatest presidents, by current standards, Herbert Hoover. But I won't be selling apples on the street. That is an impossibility. First, there's nobody on the street. Second, there's no apples. And last, even if there were apples and people, it's just way too dangerous. Neither will I be starting a GoFundMe page, a safer but oversubscribed apple selling scheme. I am exploring innovative new sources of income, the first of which I will share with you because I love you in the abstract, and I want to help you theoretically. For years now, I have managed and maintained a hole in my backyard fence that separates my property and a nature preserve. It's a gaping 5-by-12-foot beauty. It is an entire section of fence that is not there. I do not exaggerate. People tell me it's the best fence hole in northern Dutchess County. I have tended that hole for my old dog, who loves an off-leash romp in the fields out yonder. And up until now, I have been happy to share the bounty of my hole, gratis, with the occasional dog-walking neighbor, an unambitious herd of deer, a small but self-important pack of coyotes, and a family of homeschooled groundhogs. But there are no more free rides. So I have put up a tip jar next to the hole. It's an old Topps coffee tin, like roast, and I wrote the word tips on an index card with a Sharpie, and then I taped it to the can, which I then fastened to the post. I put the words at a jaunty angle to make it seem less formal and desperate. Times being what they are, this might be a fun project-based lesson for those of you with small children at home. Call it late-stage capitalism through arts and crafts, an introduction to panhandling. To you, crowd of ruminants and naysayers who are thinking, that's insane. How can you make money with a tip jar on a fence post? I say this. I still believe in the honor system. I still believe in human decency. I also still believe that erecting and staffing a toll booth isn't feasible at this juncture in time. To you myopic, doubting Thomases and Tinas, I say this. I have a vision. I have a vision and a surfeit of empty coffee cans and masking tape and a whole world by which to profit. In my sleepy village, I have launched a pilot program and strapped tip jars to everything of interest or beauty. Glorious magnolia trees, flowering forsythia, the bust of Eleanor Roosevelt, ornamental fire hydrants, and the village garbage receptacles on Main Street. My neighbor objected while I was strapping my little moneymaker to her Repeal the Safe Act lawn sign. I offered to split the proceeds with her 50-50. More than fair, in my opinion. But she wasn't interested, and timed being what they are, it is my policy never to negotiate at the end of a shotgun barrel. Once I began monetizing my holes, I realized there is no bottom. Imagine a forest of orange, brown, blue, and green coffee cans festooning every hole in every village, town, or city, representing every roast of this great nation, light and medium, dark, breakfast and dinner blends, Italian, French, and even espresso. Imagine a price for every courtesy, a tithe on each good deed, a tax on kindness. Imagine. It's easy if you try. This is America, and try you must. Times being what they are.
Yeah, that's the way they did it way back when, back in 1929. They'd hustle up the buffalo and back again, back in 1929. Yes, Mamie got a hustle for the Pigswood and a bottle, banging and sawing.
Back in 29. That's the way they did it back in 29. everyday objects to die for. Right now, you are in the renovate your home, change your life kind of thing, except the only change in your life is you are super stressed out. You're staying at a friend's place, and luckily, there's a pool around the corner, and not just any pool. The kind of indoor pool that is a thing of beauty for a swimmer like you. An enormous change room, wide lanes, huge windows that let the sun pour in, low chlorine levels, tight lane lines that absorb the waves from other swimmers, which makes your daily swim smooth. Yes, swimming in this pool is a moment of bliss in your day. Each time you plow down a lane, you feel as if you are flying. And no matter the level of crazy in your life, you're convinced this is the type of freedom given to birds. And you're not thinking weenie sparrows. No, you, my friend, are a soaring eagle. The only thing is, after your last swim, when you got back to your friend's place, you realized your phone was missing. Now, before you panic, and you will panic, you are used to this kind of thing happening because over the years you have left locks, wallets, keys, gloves, goggles, shampoo bottles, hats, and scarves at the various pools where you have swum. And while the shampoo bottles, gloves, and hats are never returned, someone always hands your wallet into the lost and found. But your phone? Seems like if someone got their grubby mitts on it, they might be somewhat reluctant to return it. Dark and shady images of underground markets for stolen phones flash through your head. The panic sets in for real now. With a sense of dread, you run the three blocks back to the pool. The door is closed, it's locked, but you keep banging because maybe someone is still inside. I mean, how could everyone be gone so quickly? Don't people linger around after their shift? Why is everyone always in such a hurry these days anyway? This is what you're thinking as you stand there, banging on a door that will not open for you, that feels like it will never open for you ever again. You head to your friends, plod back, feet and heart heavy. You sit on the end of your little bed. Your entire life is on that phone. All your contacts, your notes, your shopping lists, the films you want to see, the books you want to read, random thoughts you have like why are napkins not called lapkins and why do British people have no accent when they sing? Plus all the dates for your ongoing mega renovation from hell that you can't afford to pay for. You fling yourself at your laptop, open it, Christ, why is it so damn slow? You type in Find My Phone on your keyboard, and there, boom, the most beautiful page on the entire web opens, showing a map of the neighborhood, and one glorious round dot. Your phone, and its current address, and it's close, really close. In fact, it's across the street from the pool, because of course the grubby little huckster who ripped off your phone lives around the corner, because it's a neighborhood pool. You are out the door so fast. You are strutting down the street with indignation and purpose. You're not sure yet exactly what you're going to say to this sticky-fingered phone-stealing bandit, but as you get closer, it does begin to occur to you that anger and outrage might not be the most effective tone for this situation. Just as you're considering some options, you arrive at the address. You double-check the number and the street, because this is not a single dwelling. It's an apartment building. Okay. Not a huge one, but still, 7 units. Besides each number on the buzzer, there is no name, no info, just blank space and more blank space. Through sheer luck, because the phone-finding gods are on your side, the front door is open, ajar a few inches, like in a horror movie. You step inside and head boldly to door number 1 and knock. No answer. You head to door number 2 and knock. No answer. Door number 3. No answer. Where is everyone? It's 8 p.m. People should be home eating dinner like normal human beings. It's not even a Friday or a Saturday. It's a Wednesday. You head to door number 4. The sound of people yelling drowns out your persistent knocking. You think you hear a scream, but it's an empty scream. Not frightening. And is someone laughing? Maybe. Because there's also loud music playing. Hard rock. The kind of music drug dealers who side pedal in phone theft might listen to. You decide you need a simple story, something like, the Find My Phone app shows that the phone is here in this building and I'd just like to thank the Good Samaritan who picked up my phone for me. You've been knocking for a good 10 minutes, which is why you have time to think of this while your knuckles turn red. Finally, the door opens and it's not a drug dealer or a phone thief, but a little girl, naked, except for a pair of purple panties. She's got a round belly and is sucking one of her fingers and has that glaze in her eyes most kids have for adults they don't know, because adults they don't know aren't interesting because they're not likely to give them things they need like love and food and toys. A shadow moves behind her and then a man appears. Her father, right? He's naked also except for a pair of underwear. Yes, her father. He has to be your father. No. They don't have your phone. You knock on door number 5 and unleash the high-pitched, persistent yapping of a dog. Probably the kind of little dog that's carried around in its owner's arms all day, has a pink bow on its head and is probably missing a few teeth so his tongue always hangs out to one side. It's exactly that kind of yapping. The door doesn't open, but an elderly woman's voice from behind it asks you what you want, and before you can get your story out, she tells you firmly to go away. Go away. You knock on door number 6. A smiley, sweaty-faced man with an enormous TV playing in the background invites you inside. My God, that TV is massive. Titanic-sized. What do the poor people in whatever factory in whatever part of the world, wherever it was built, think of such a ridiculous contraption? Oh God, you hope it wasn't built by kids. The door closes behind you. You explain your story, and the man asks for your phone number, and you give it to him, which a millisecond afterwards you realize was one mega dumb idea. You watch him punch in the numbers on his phone, and after a few seconds, you hear a tinny version of your voice from your messaging system. Hey, this is you-know-who. I'm you-know-where. Leave your you-know-what-you-know-when. Ah, the man says, you're one of those funny girls. When he says funny girls, you laugh like you've coughed or choked on something. Such a pain to lose a phone, he says. Could he have your email address? The building is a condo, you see, and he's head of the board, and he'll send a message out to everyone asking about your phone. You feel numb. Why do you give him your email address? It's the humongous TV and the poor children who built it and the sound of your voice in your hands and the feeling of each one of these things colliding with another. He stumbles over the spelling of your name. M, you say, like Montreal. Well, M, like Montreal, we'll find your phone. I promise. He asks if he can get you something to drink, some water maybe. You must be thirsty. You don't know what to say, where to look, and you wonder if you are weird because the entire exchange has begun to resemble an opening episode of CSI Miami. Would you risk your life for your iPhone? A dull, blunt realization hits you because, yes, not knowingly, but stupidly, naively, yes, you would probably risk your life for your damn iPhone. Isn't that exactly what you're doing by stepping into this strange man's apartment and giving him all your contact info? He wipes a sweaty strand of hair out of his face and tells you it's been years since he's been to the pool. Do you go there often? He asks. You lie. You back towards the door, say, thank you, you are very grateful for his help, you say, as you reach for the doorknob that is, thank God, not locked. Out on the landing, your heart is pounding so fast, all you can do is stand very still until it slows down. Finally, you knock on the last door, number 7. It's a relief when the big, handsome guy answers, but no, he doesn't have your phone. You should ask the man across the hall, though, he says. He goes to the pool all the time. That evening, you find yourself constantly reaching for, you know what. You wonder who has it. What are they doing to it? Are they breaking your passcode? Scrolling through your photos, laughing at the typos in your shopping list. Auberginians, Patsaus, Toothy Pots. You miss your phone like you miss a close confidant. One who always has cat memes and horoscope readings, but who knows all the capitals of all the cities and can articulate what is consciousness and can answer the question, is happiness the most important purpose in life? The next day, you are standing outside the pool waiting for it to open, and as soon as it does, you head straight to the lifeguard's office. But no, no one turned in your phone. You head to your locker. You use the same one as always, just as you always swim in the same lane, because certain habits ground you in this uncertain world. You can't believe how lonely you feel. You miss the annoying ringtone you never got around to changing, the inevitable and annoying flurry of text messages when you're on a deadline. You miss how needy your phone is, constantly demanding to be updated and recharged. You kick off your flip-flops, lay them on the top shelf, and feel the outer edges of its case before you see it. That's when you realize it's right where you left it, your phone.
return to me. That's all I need to find you in the filigree, so we can hold tight the whole night. It's alright, I hope you'll agree, 'cause you made me be.
Saint Mavrikios and his son, the martyr Photios, appear in the icon to be content. The father, whipped with a barbed scourge, bloody, covered in honey and in wasps, and tied to a tree, head inclined downward toward the body of his beheaded boy, yet raises his eyes to heaven. Today is their feast day. The vicious bios read this morning recalled my questions for these converts, the repentant killers from the infamous Theban legion. Did they even feel the lash, or was it grace that healed them? Did they grit their teeth behind their smiles? The icon will not say one way or the other. Like flies in amber, the scene is set, and no one dares interpret, least of all myself. But I remember, too, my ancient abbess, on this same day some years before, met her nephew Lycus in the church. the lad she had not seen in decades, said to him offhandedly, "Likey, remember when your father tied you to a tree and whipped you all day?" He smiled, lips compressed and twisted. Then he turned his eyeballs into knives and cut her throat with them.
This is a song called Sailor's Prayer. Hi, Smudge. It's the cat. Anyway, this song strikes me as suitable for these times we're living in. Sailor's Prayer. Though my sails be torn and ragged, and my mast be turned about, though the night wind chill me to my very soul, though the salt spray sting my eye, and the stars no light provide, give me just another morning light to hold. I will not lie me down, this rain a-raging. I will not lie me down in such a storm. And if this night be unblessed, I shall not take my rest till I reach another shore. All my friends are drained and weary, and it seems their hopes are lost. But there's no need for our bones on that blackened bottom. And if death waits just off the bow, we shall not answer now. He will stand and face the morning without us. I will not lie me down, this rain a-raging. I will not lie me down in such a storm. And if this night be unblessed, I shall not take my rest till I reach another shore. I will not lie me down, this rain a-raging. I will not lie me down in such a storm. And if this night be unblessed, I shall not take my rest till we reach another shore. Till we reach the other shore. Stay safe.
Therapy. Another rejection letter could stuff a pillow with them. Papier-mâché them into a doorstop, rake them into a pile, and burn them like fall leaves. Fold them into origami swans and float them down river somewhere where the current is swift and rough. Mince them into confetti. Have a party. Knock, knock. The heart beat the gong, dragged a fish from the inner circus, made a most ardent sizzle. Melted by candle flicker of a low budget dream, sent a letter from the rich internal world. Bring the tiger. Thank you.
don't sneak out on the side. He just does it when he rolls into your room. And what he took, you don't mind, 'cause he gives it back all the time. He don't bug you, he just comes and goes. Well, he don't know you, but he likes you, and he loves to get up inside you. What you don't need is someone who lie, cheat and steal. And off to work, back by 8. Not much to eat anyway, it's late. The house is cold, leave the heat at 62. It's good enough to wake to. Out of here by 7. Hey, it's good enough to wake to. In the morning, out of here by 7. You go where he takes you, no one knows. It's a place for lovers, and soon it disappears. And there's a hurt deep inside, you don't see it, don't realize. It's a hurt that's been there since you were 5. Hey, it's good enough wake to. In the morning, out of here by 7.